content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the 2-week issue dated December 29th, 2023, and January 5th, 2024. We are in our year-end issue of the week. It's titled The Faces of 2023. Always look forward to it, especially the cover drawings. I believe this is, if I'm counting right, this may be the 11th one I've done, and I always enjoy it. So, the cover drawing for The Faces of 2023 is a courtroom scene. At the defendant's table is a scowling Donald Trump. Sitting next to him is the new House Speaker Mike Johnson holding up a copy of the Bible. At the prosecutor's table is Jack Smith, special counsel. He's standing up and pointing a finger at Trump. And next to him, also at the prosecutor's table, is it Franny Willis, the Georgia Fulton County district attorney who also brought charges against Trump. Back in the courtroom itself, right behind the prosecutors, is a screaming Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's holding up a picture of Hunter Biden. It seems like he's in a hotel room with his shirt off, maybe smoking a joint. Nikki Haley is giving Ron DeSantis a shove in the back, and he's fallen down and spilling his coffee. Elon Musk is holding one of the Twitter birds with an angry look on his face and strangling it. Joe Biden is sitting behind all this with his legs kicked up and his arms behind his head, smiling with his sunglasses on. Back over on the other side, Taylor Swift is standing up and belting out a song. Sam Bankman-Fried is in an orange prison outfit with handcuffs, looking grim. And there is the Chinese spy balloon floating in the back of the room. And finally, headed out the door is Kevin McCarthy, former House Speaker. He's looking back over his shoulder and waving goodbye. As usual, it was quite a year, The Faces of 2023. Starting with a editor's note here. Let me find it. This is typical. Note to readers. The week's staff is taking a 2-week break for the holidays. Our next edition will be dated January 19th and should begin arriving on January 12th. The week currently publishes 48 issues a year. Well, what does that mean for us? That means we will get 2 readings out of this issue. We'll start this week with the newsy stuff, and next week we'll do the end of year stuff. And that program, the end of year program, will actually run for 2 weeks. So, a lot said to get started with the main stories and how they were covered. U.S. pushes Israel to scale down war in Gaza. What happened? Officials from the U.S. and Arab world engaged this week in a flurry of diplomacy aimed at securing a new ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, as the Biden administration urged Israel to move away from high-intensity airstrikes and ground assaults in devastated Gaza. During a visit to Tel Aviv, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin called America's support for Israel ironclad, but said he had discussed with Israeli counterpart how to implement more surgical operations. Austin's trip came just days after National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met with Israeli officials and urged a shift to a different phase of the war focused more on special operations and smaller bombs. Some 20,000 Palestinians have been killed in the 10-week war, according to Hamas-run health authorities in Gaza. And almost half of the territory's 2 million residents have been displaced. Many are packed into shelters and tent camps near the Egyptian border, where aid workers said food, water, and medical supplies were perilously low. Israeli officials said they were willing to agree to a temporary ceasefire deal that would see Hamas release some of its estimated 129 Israeli hostages. Israel would let more aid into Gaza as part of the agreement. In a sign that talks were advancing, Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh left his home in Qatar to meet with Egyptian officials in Cairo. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces mounting anger at home over the hostage crisis, with pressure rising after Israeli forces mistakenly killed three hostages in Gaza last week. The hostages, shirtless and carrying a white flag, were shot after they emerged from a building in Gaza. The soldiers acted during combat and under pressure, said an army official. What the editorial said. After Hamas' horrific October 7th attack, Israel had broad support around the world, said the Los Angeles Times. But no matter how evil, the terrorist atrocities don't justify Israel's wanton bombing of Palestinian civilians. Having leveled northern Gaza, its forces are now laying waste to the south as horrified nations plead for a halt in fighting. The U.S., which blocked a ceasefire resolution at the U.N. Security Council, must demand its ally end the carnage. Hope can only begin when wholesale killing ends. If Israel were made to end its offensive now, it would be a grievous turn of events, said the Washington Examiner. Forced into war by Hamas' pogrom, it must wipe out the militants' political and military capabilities. A newly discovered attack tunnel by the Israeli border, big enough to drive a car through, makes clear that Hamas remains an existential threat. Israeli troops are making progress, but the job is not yet done. Helping Israel finish off Hamas must be Biden's top priority. What the columnist said. The shocking shootings of three hostages left Israelis stunned and speechless, said Tia Goldenberg in the Associated Press. The killing of the men who waved a white flag and yelled out in Hebrew would have violated basic military ethics and international law, even if they were combatants, said human rights watchdogs. For Israel's critics, the deaths underscore what they saw in the military's excessively violent conduct towards civilians in Gaza. How many Palestinians, they ask, have died in similar circumstances? Growing outrage at Israel is creating problems for Biden at home, said Jonathan Weitzman in the New York Times. A new Times poll shows voters broadly disapprove of how he's handling the conflict, with younger Americans especially critical of his strong backing of Israel. Three-quarters of voters ages 18 to 29 disapprove of his approach. Among registered voters in that group, Biden has lost 4 percentage points to Trump since July. Meanwhile, Netanyahu is ignoring Biden's calls for caution to appease his right-wing coalition, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. He's counting on a hardline approach to keep him in office, no matter how much damage that does to Israel's long-term security interest or its relationship with its staunchest ally. Even if a hostage deal leads to a pause in the campaign, Israeli officials are clear they are settling in for a long war, said Ishan Tharoor in the Washington Post. But Hamas isn't easily defeated. The terrorists have not been beaten, even as Israel has flattened whole neighborhoods, triggered a sprawling humanitarian disaster, and found itself flailing in a losing battle for global public opinion. Instead of destroying Hamas, they've destroyed Gaza, ensuring the bloody cycle of Israeli-Palestinian violence will continue. second shorter main story. Colorado court rules Trump ineligible for presidency. What happened? Colorado's highest court this week deemed Donald Trump an insurrectionist and disqualified him from appearing on state ballots, an unprecedented move that threatens to force a showdown at the U.S. Supreme Court. The seven justices on Colorado's state Supreme Court, all Democratic appointees, decided 4-3 that Trump's actions on January 6, 2021, justified his removal from state ballots under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which bars office seekers who have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the U.S. government. Trump literally exhorted his supporters to fight at the Capitol that day, the majority opinion reads. Our Constitution clearly states that those who violate their oath by attacking our democracy are barred from serving in government. The court paused the ruling until at least January 4, 2024, the day before all presidential candidates must be certified in Colorado. Trump's campaign vowed to appeal, and on Truth Social, Trump baselessly called the decision the work of the DOJ and the White House. His Republican presidential rivals also issued condemnations. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis accused the court of abusing judicial power. And Chris Christie argued that letting unelected judges reject candidates is bad for the country. The court's three dissenters called automatic disqualification a dangerous precedent. Our government cannot deprive someone of the right to hold public office without due process, wrote Justice Carlos Samuel. Keeping Trump off only some state ballots, he added, risks chaos in our country. What the columnist said. The Colorado Supreme Court has made history in the most chilling way possible, said Jonathan Turley in The Messenger. They unilaterally branded Trump an insurrectionist and claimed the right to invalidate votes for him. Other states have rejected this argument against Trump, which would produce tit-for-tat disqualifications of every candidate by the opposing party. The Supreme Court is likely to overturn this decision, and Trump will almost certainly remain on the ballot. Still, Americans won't forget this effort to take away their vote. This was about applying the letter of the law, said John Avlon in CNN.com. The Colorado Supreme Court overturned the decision of a lower court that ruled Trump had indeed engaged in insurrection, but tried to skirt the issue by saying that the 14th Amendment does not explicitly mention the presidency among the offices that are barred for anyone who has engaged in rebellion. That's an absurdly implausible technicality. The 14th Amendment was made precisely for moments like this. Politically, though, this is an early Christmas present for Trump, said Mark Z. Baraback in the Los Angeles Times. It makes him more sympathetic to the GOP base, diminishing his rivals' already fading hopes of an upset. Trump has a clear path to the nomination and beating Joe Biden. Democrats keep hoping for an easy out, but a courtroom is no place to decide a presidential election. U.S.-led force to protect shipping from Houthi attacks. What happened? An Iran-based Houthi militants intensified their drone and missile attacks on commercial shipping in the Red Sea. The U.S. this week launched a multinational task force to patrol one of the world's most economically critical bodies of water. Nine other countries signed on to the Operation Prosperity Guardian, including the U.K., Canada, and France, but major Middle Eastern powers like Egypt or Saudi Arabia did not. From their bases in Yemen, the Houthis have been targeting cargo ships and fuel tankers passing through the strait between the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea. At least 10 ships have been hijacked or hit in the past 2 months. And on just one day last week, the U.S. shot down 14 Houthi drones. The Houthis say they are attacking ships bound for Israel. out of solidarity with the Palestinians under assault in Gaza, but they have struck multiple ships that had no connection to Israel. These attacks are reckless, dangerous, and they violate international law, said Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. This is an international problem, and it deserves an international response. The Houthi attacks threaten to snarl global supply chains. About 30% of container shipping normally passes through the Red Sea, but now the major shipping and oil companies have rerouted their ships to sail around Africa, adding about 12 days to their journey. The international oil benchmark has risen about 8%, while some shipping rates spiked 20%. The cost of the U.S. effort to combat the Houthis will also rise, because the missiles the Navy uses to destroy Houthi drones cost some $2 million each. These drones cost the Yemeni militants just $2,000 each, what the columnist said. The attacks have been a disaster for global trade, said Elizabeth Braw in Foreign Policy. Shipping giants like Maersk, Hapag-Lloyd, and Yang Ming have joined the exodus from the Red Sea, which will cause a dramatic plunge in traffic through the Suez Canal. The cost to consumers this holiday season could be considerable. Redirecting ships around Africa adds about $1 million to the cost of each round-trip voyage, and the supply chain disruptions will push prices even higher. The Houthis are clearly trying to take global commerce hostage to force Israel's hand, said Gregory Brew in Time. Over the course of the decade-long Yemeni civil war, the group has taken control of much of Yemen, and they are now using this crisis to show off their capabilities and boost their regional prestige. Like their patron Iran, they hope to pressure Israel to end its war against Hamas in Gaza, expect them to keep launching missiles despite the presence of a U.S.-led naval force. Make no mistake, Iran is ultimately responsible for this Houthi offensive, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. So it's Iran that must be deterred. It is encouraging that the Biden administration is now reportedly drawing up plans for military strikes against Houthi ammunition stores and missile launch sites. To send a real message, the offensive should be extensive, not mere pinprick strikes like those conducted against Iranian proxies in Syria and Iraq. And eventually, Iran's mullahs will have to be put on notice that their assets, military and nuclear, are at risk. Controversy of the week. Election 2024. Will it be a referendum on abortion rights? It's like clockwork, said Zachary Basu in Axios. Every time Republicans appear to be building political momentum, voters get a reminder of the GOP's gaping and still unresolved vulnerabilities on abortion rights. Earlier this month, it was the harrowing story of Kate Cox, the Dallas mother of two who fled Texas for medical care after the state refused to let her terminate a non-viable pregnancy that threatened her fertility. Now it's the news that the Supreme Court will hear an appeal of a lower court ruling that would curb women's access to mifepristone, barring the commonly used abortion pill from being sent by mail or prescribed by telemedicine. That announcement has Republicans nervous, said Ellie Quinlan Hoteling in the New Republic. Since the court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, support for abortion has surged, with majorities in nearly all 50 states, including ruby red states, saying the procedure should be legal in all or most cases. Energized voters have approved ballot initiatives securing abortion rights in states from Michigan to Ohio, and handed massive election victories to pro-abortion rights Democrats, such as Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. If the court further restricts women's reproductive choices in a ruling expected next summer, the turning tide of public opinion could become a tsunami that wipes out Republicans in November. Isn't this what Republicans wanted? Asked Kate Zernike in the New York Times. For the 49 years of the Roe era, conservatives insisted the court had squelched the democratic process by imposing a federal right to abortion. All they wanted, they said, was for the issue to be returned to the states, where voters could sort out a consensus. That wish came true, but because Republicans don't like the consensus, they're now trying to keep the issue away from voters. They're appealing to the Supreme Court, whose interference they once bemoaned, and in states where pro-choice activists are gathering signatures for ballot initiatives, including Florida or Arizona and Nevada, anti-abortion groups are running decline-to-sign campaigns aimed at keeping the measures off the ballot. The growing voter backlash is something we pro-lifers didn't see coming, said Nicole Russell in Newsweek, and we need to make adjustments. That doesn't mean compromising our belief in the sanctity of life, but as the heartbreaking story of Kate Cox made clear, we should craft compassionate laws that make room for complications. There's no use in bemoaning the electoral problems caused by Roe's toppling, said Kimberly Ross in Washington Examiner. Republicans instead need to find new ways of reaching women voters. Former Donald Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway may be onto something with her call for the GOP to stop talking about abortion and embrace access to contraception. Good luck with that, said Molly Olmsted in Slate. A more pro-woman message might make political sense, but that won't wash with the GOP base, whose opposition to Roe always sprang from a deeper rejection of feminism, the sexual revolution, and women's rights generally. Those true believers haven't abandoned their goal of a national abortion ban, said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. Some conservative legal scholars are now floating the theory that a president could impose a ban through the Justice Department, bypassing Congress and the courts. With Trump running ahead of President Biden in many 2024 polls, the dystopian horror Kate Cox fled in Texas could soon be a national reality. And here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for evolution after marine biologists discovered a dolphin with hook-shaped thumbs on its flippers swimming off the coast of Greece. The deformed thumb may have some bone inside it, said anatomist Lisa Cooper, but it certainly isn't mobile. It's a good week for cat videos after NASA used a new laser communication system to beam a 15-second high-definition video of an engineer's cat, Taters, to Earth from deep space. The clip of Taters playing with a laser pointer made its 19-million-mile journey in only 101 seconds. It was a good week for socialism after former President Donald Trump, who boasted in office that the stock market was setting one record after another, complained to supporters in Reno, Nevada, that today's even higher stock prices are only making rich people richer. But it was a bad week for priorities after the House, wrapping up a historically unproductive legislative session, passed a bill overturning an Obama-era ban of full-fat milk in schools. Among other benefits, said Representative Virginia Fox, Republican from North Carolina, whole milk is the fuel Santa needs to travel the whole globe in one night. It was a bad week for decorum after a Democratic aide who was fired for allegedly filming a gay sex tape in a Senate hearing room said he was considering his legal options. This has been a difficult time for me, said Aiden Mace Sapotsky, 24, as I have been attacked for who I love. Finally, it was a bad week for America, where the term most commonly entered into online dictionaries this year was gaslighting, a form of psychological abuse. Procrastination was the most searched for definition in France. And a short other news, in other news piece while we're here. Meadows loses bid to move Georgia case to federal court. Panel of federal judges unanimously rejected a request this week from Donald Trump's former White House chief of staff, Mark Meadows, to have his case moved to federal court. The panel ruled that his alleged efforts to subvert Joe Biden's 2020 victory in Georgia were not related to his White House job. The decision appears to lower the chances that former President Trump or any of the other 18 co-defendants accused of racketeering and other crimes will be able to shift the case to a more favorable jurisdiction. The chief of staff's role does not include altering ballot election results in favor of a particular candidate. 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals Chief Judge William Pryor, an appointee of President George W. Bush, wrote in a decision joined by two Democrat-appointed judges. We'll read some of the U.S. at a glance and the world is at a glance pieces this week. Starting with the U.S. at a glance, we are in Austin, Texas. Migrant crackdown. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed a sweeping measure this week that allows state and local police to arrest migrants who illegally enter from Mexico, drawing an immediate lawsuit from El Paso County, which says it won't enforce the law. The case could reach the U.S. Supreme Court, which could take the opportunity to revisit a 2012 decision affirming the federal government's authority over immigration policies. Biden's deliberate inaction has left Texas to fend for itself, Abbott said. The law would allow migrants who entered illegally to be ordered to return to Mexico or face prosecution, without regard for whether they've made an asylum claim. This approach is so extreme, Abbott said, we expect a dramatic drop. Well over 50%, maybe 75% of the people coming over the border illegally. Texas has faced a surge of migrants, creating potent images of thousands of arrivals overwhelming border facilities. Waterloo, Iowa. Former President Trump doubled down this week on his new stump speech line that undocumented immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country, dismissing suggestions that he's echoing Adolf Hitler by saying, I never read Mein Kampf. Trump's attack on migrants, who he says come from mental institutions, drew criticism from some Senate Republicans, including Susan Collins of Maine, who called the remarks deplorable, and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. But Trump's allies appeared unbothered. Tommy Tuberville of Alabama said, I'm mad he wasn't tougher than that. And Ohio's J.D. Vance said, it's obviously true that illegal immigrants were poisoning the blood of the country. In recent speeches, Trump has also quoted Russian President Vladimir Putin, saying that the U.S. cannot pretend to teach others about democracy. Sea Island, Georgia. GoFundMe. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas began receiving generous gifts from his new conservative friends after he began threatening to resign over financial strain in 2000. ProPublica reported this week, the thought of losing the reliably conservative justice reportedly panicked right-wing circles, leading to favors big and small. His nephew's private school tuition paid, a loan for a luxury RV forgiven, international vacations with billionaire Harlan Crow. This came after Thomas, then in his early 50s, and hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, complained at a conservative conference in Sea Island, Georgia, about his salary, $173,600, equivalent to a little more than $300,000 today, and a court prohibition on paid speeches. Thomas' money troubles were seen as a delicate matter among court officials, and Thomas warned one Florida congressman directly that without a salary increase, one or more justices will leave soon. Washington, D.C. No deal. Senate negotiators abandoned hope this week of striking a deal on Ukraine aid and U.S. border funding before the holiday recess, despite leaders of both parties saying they're making encouraging progress. President Biden and Senate Democrats are seeking about $61 billion in military support for Ukraine, noting that without it, Ukraine will soon run out of critical weapons and supplies in its war with Russia. But Republicans insist that further aid to Kyiv will be paired with funding to bolster U.S. southern border security and tougher immigration policies. The bill would also include funding for Israel and Taiwan. Negotiations will now carry into the new year, when Congress must also reach a spending deal in order to avert part of the federal government shutting down. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, issued a rare joint statement with hopes for quick action on national security in early 2024. And the world at a glance. We're in Grindavik, Iceland. Volcano erupts. An Icelandic volcano that has been spitting and rumbling since November finally erupted this week, spewing gases and lava from a fissure 2.5 miles long. The sky glowed red 25 miles away in Reykjavik, the capital, and authorities issued an air quality alert for volcanic gases. The closest town to the eruption, the fishing village of Grindavik, was evacuated weeks ago because of the thousands of earthquakes shaking the region, and is now threatened by the rapidly expanding eruption zone. But volcanologists say the town could still be spared, and that they don't currently anticipate disruptions to air travel. "We now wait," said President Gudni Johannesson, "to see what the forces of nature have in store." Quito, Ecuador. Lead source pinpointed. An Ecuadorian spice company may have intentionally added lead to the cinnamon used in fruit pouches that have sickened at least 65 young children in the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration said this week. The FDA began inspecting plants of fruit company Austrofood earlier this month after its Wanabana applesauce pouches were found to contain 2,000 times the safe concentration of lead. The agencies believe the source was contaminated cinnamon and are investigating Austrofood's spice supplier, Negasmart. Agricultural products can contain lead naturally if grown in contaminated soil, but we do sometimes see intentionally contaminated products that are sold by weight, Diane Colello of the New Jersey Poison Control Center told CNN. And the best way to make something heavy is to put metal in it. Vatican City. Blessing same-sex unions. Pope Francis will allow priests to bless same-sex unions, the Vatican's doctrine office announced this week, although the sacrament of marriage remains restricted to heterosexual couples. The Vatican said any such blessing must be performed privately, not as part of a civil union ceremony, and the couple should not be dressed in wedding clothes. There is no intention to legitimize anything, but rather to open one's life to God, it said. The new directive is an about-face from the policy issued just 2 years ago when the Vatican said same-sex unions could not be blessed because God cannot bless sin. Since assuming the papacy in 2013, Francis, 87, has made the church progressively more welcoming to LGBTQ Catholics. Moscow, anger over Finland-U.S. deal. Finland opened its 830-mile border with Russia to the U.S. military this week, prompting Russia to summon the Finnish ambassador and threaten retaliation for the aggressive decisions of Finland and its NATO allies. Finland clinched the defense deal, with the U.S., allowing American troops to access to Finnish military bases. After Russia sent hundreds of asylum seekers across Finland's border in retaliation for Finland's decision earlier this year to end decades of military neutrality and join NATO. Russia now says it will not leave unanswered the buildup of NATO military potential on our border. Denmark and Sweden also signed defense cooperation deals in recent weeks to allow the U.S. to base soldiers and equipment in their territory. Wad Madani, Sudan. Rebel Sea City. At least 300,000 people fled Sudan's second city last week when the rebel rapid support forces swept in and began battling for control of the main army base there. Wad Madani has been a relatively peaceful haven in the civil war, which broke out in April after a power-sharing agreement between the RSF and the army fell apart, and 500,000 residents of the capital, Khartoum, had fled there for safety. Now they are fleeing again. More than 12,000 people have been killed over the 8 months of the conflict, and nearly 7 million have had to leave their homes. The horror in Sudan continues, said Sophie Carlson of the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Where are people going to go? Tehran. Cyber attack hits gas stations. An Israeli-linked hijacker group claimed responsibility for disabling two-thirds of Iran's 33,000 gas stations this week in a day-long cyber attack. The attack knocked the gas station's payment systems offline, leading to long lines of cars and angry crowds at some stations. The group, called Gonjeshki Durande, or Predatory Sparrow, said it was responding to the aggression of the Islamic Republic and its proxies in the region, such as Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Houthis. It said it warned Irani emergency services ahead of time and left enough gas stations unaffected to allow ambulances to fuel up. Gonjeshki Durande has carried out previous cyber attacks on Iranian targets, including one last year that hit major steel companies. The briefing in this issue is a different sort of Christmas story. When Santa fought for the Union, how the bloodshed and turmoil of the Civil War helped make the modern American Christmas. What was Christmas like in the war? For a country locked in the bloodiest conflict of its history, Christmas was a moment of hope and pain. Its celebration of family togetherness tapped into the yearnings of homesick soldiers and the loved ones they'd left, and heightened the agony of those whose husbands, sons, and brothers were among the war's 620,000 military dead. Margaret Cahill wrote to her Union officer husband on December 26, 1861, that she tried to write him on Christmas Day, but I felt so nervous and lonely I could not. The North and South each used the holiday as a propaganda weapon, and Atlanta newspaper declared Dixie to be a confederacy of Christmas states, while illustrations in Harper's Weekly depicted Father Christmas as a staunch Union supporter. And when the war ended, millions embraced Christmas as a way to reunify a broken country. The Civil War intensified Christmas appeal, said University of Texas historian Penny L. Restad. Its message of peace and goodwill spoke to the most immediate prayers of all Americans. How did Americans celebrate before 1861? In the early 1800s, Christmas was largely a religious holiday and one overlooked by many Americans. But by the middle of the century, Victorian-era enthusiasts had turned into a more secular and popular festivity. Christmas cards and gift-giving were in vogue. The first department store Santa had appeared in Philadelphia, and German-inspired Christmas trees were everywhere. In December 1853, Robert E. Lee's daughter wrote in her diary that her father, then a superintendent at West Point, later the Confederacy's top commander, had an evergreen decked with sugared fruit, silver foil, and glass ornaments. But the season's joy dissipated as conflict between North and South grew more likely. "Christmas has come around," an Arkansas diarist wrote in 1860, "but there is a gloom on the thoughts and countenance of all the better portion of our people." 4 months later, the nation was at war. How did soldiers mark Christmas? Often they just kept fighting. In 1862, Confederate Brigadier General John Hunt Morgan staged his Christmas raid, smashing Union supply lines in Kentucky. 2 years later, Union Major General William T. Sherman offered the newly captured city of Savannah to President Abraham Lincoln as a Christmas gift, with 150 heavy guns and plenty of ammunition. Ordinary troops got presents as well. Many received holiday boxes from home, containing food, clothes, and maybe a bottle of whiskey, and extra rations. Some regiments would organize Christmas games, including foot races and greased pig catching contest. In a few instances, Union and Confederate forces met to swap goods and stage snowball fights. "We forgot the biting wind, the chilling cold," one former Union soldier wrote of a momentary truce. "We forgot those men over there were our enemies, whom it might be our duty to shoot before evening." What about the home front? Many women spent the holiday season tending to the sick and wounded and making clothes for loved ones in uniform. Because of the shortage of materials, children typically received modest Christmas gifts, such as homemade toys, candy, and popcorn balls. Union blockades meant youngsters in the South got less. General Howell Cobb's children were told not to expect Santa because the Yankees had shot him. The Richmond, Virginia Examiner declared outright that there was no Santa, blasting St. Nick as a Dutch toy monger who was completely alien to genuine Virginia hospitality and Christmas merrymakings. But Santa would outlast the Confederacy, thanks in large part to Harper's Weekly cartoonist Thomas Nast, who would later popularize the donkey and the elephant as symbols of the Democratic and Republican parties. Did Nast change Santa's image? He turned him into a war hero. Borrowing from Clement Clark Moore's 1822 poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, better known as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, Nast's drawing cemented Santa in the popular imagination as a jolly, white-bearded gift-giver. His St. Nick was also fiercely pro-Union. In one 1863 cartoon, Santa appears in a star-spangled suit, entertaining Union soldiers with a puppet of Confederate President Jefferson Davis hanging by a noose. Another cartoon from that year shows Santa approaching a chimney while, in separate circles, a woman prays at home, and her soldier husband, on picket duty by a campfire, looks at photos of his family. President Lincoln took notice, calling Nast our best recruiting sergeant. By 1865, Nast Santa was proclaiming Merry Christmas to all in a display of post-war goodwill, a message undercut only slightly by the cartoonist's inclusion of the severed heads of several Confederate generals. What happened after the war? Christmas became an opportunity for reconciliation. Nast's 1866 illustration, Santa Claus and His Works, depicts Saint Nick in his toy workshop, located for the first time at the North Pole, which Nast chose for his political neutrality. On Christmas Day 1868, outgoing President Andrew Johnson, who had just survived impeachment, unconditionally pardoned all former Confederate soldiers and leaders for their treason. 2 years later, Congress decreed December 25th, one of the first federal holidays. The scars of the Civil War would never fully disappear, but Christmas' new customs and meanings helped the nation to make sense of the confusion of the era, said historian Ristad, and to secure, if only for a short while each year, a soothing feeling of unity. Christmas in chains. For the nearly 4 million black American slaves, Christmas in the mid-1800s was a treacherous time. Some would be granted days off by owners and given food, small presents, and passes to travel and visit family. Romanticized tales of plantation Christmases would sustain lost cause nostalgia long after 1865, but that veneer of benevolence, Frederick Douglass wrote, masked the slave owner's real goal, keeping down the spirit of insurrection. Panics over Christmastime slave revolts in the Caribbean meant that any suspicious-seeming behavior could lead to whippings or execution. Come New Year's Day, owners often hired out slaves, tearing families apart. Some slaves used the small freedoms they received over Christmas to escape. In December 1848, married couple William and Ellen Craft, granted a travel pass by their owners in Macon, Georgia, fled north by train and steamer. The light-skinned Ellen disguised herself as an injured white man, while William playing his manservant. They arrived in Philadelphia on Christmas Day. "Thank God, William," Ellen told her husband. "We're safe." And we'll turn over to the Talking Points page. Should have enough here to finish out the show. Start with the article, Trump, should he be immune to prosecution? Special Counsel Jack Smith just pulled a serious poker move, said Illy Mistel in The Nation. Smith asked last week for an expedited Supreme Court review of Donald Trump's principal defense, that he's immune from criminal prosecution for anything he did while president, including allegedly conspiring to subvert the 2020 election. That outlandish argument runs counter to the very idea of the rule of law. U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan rejected Trump's motion, and Smith wants the Supreme Court to leapfrog lower courts and deny Trump's appeal so that the trial, now scheduled to begin March 4th, is not delayed beyond the 2024 election. The Supreme Court agreed to quickly review Smith's request, but the special counsel's gamble could backfire if five justices side with Trump. The court has three Trump appointees in addition to Fox News' Uncle Samuel Alito and the equally partisan Clarence Thomas, whose activist wife, Jenny, frantically urged Republicans to keep Trump in power, calling Joe Biden's victory the greatest heist in our history. Smith didn't say in his Supreme Court filing why it matters if Trump's trial is delayed, said Jason Willick in the Washington Post. The obvious subtext, if Trump is not tried and convicted by the election, the chances of Biden's victory will take a hit. Trump wants the trial delayed so that he can spend a campaign attacking Biden for weaponizing the Justice Department without being stained by a potential guilty verdict. If he's elected before the trial takes place, He will direct the DOJ to drop all charges. That should worry Democrats, but not the supposedly impartial Smith, who has made it clear he's an aggressive political actor. Smith is absolutely right, said Jesse Wegman in the New York Times, which is why the Supreme Court is hearing the case. The American people deserve to know, well before they head to the polls, whether one candidate criminally conspired to overturn the last presidential election. Trump, however, hopes to exploit the Achilles heel of democracy, said Paul Rosenzweig in the Atlantic. Due process is easily manipulated by the maliciously inclined. Trump is notorious for filing a blizzard of nonsensical motions and appeals to gum up the courts. And he's doing exactly that in all four of his criminal cases. Let's hope the Supreme Court recognizes what a dangerous moment this is for the rule of law. Moms for Liberty, a co-founder's sex scandal. It's hypocrisy on steroids, said Fabiola Santiago in the Miami Herald. Moms for Liberty co-founder Bridget Ziegler, the woman who led an ultra-conservative movement that sought to put gays back in the closet, has admitted that she was involved in a three-way sexual affair with her husband and another woman. This revelation emerged when the other woman told police she had been raped by Ziegler's husband, Florida Republican Party Chairman Christian Ziegler, after she declined another thruple encounter and informed him she was always more interested in his wife. Christian Ziegler, now under active investigation by police, was censured by the state party this week and may soon be removed from his post. Bridget Ziegler sits on the Sarasota School Board, which voted in a non-binding resolution to remove her, but she refused to resign. The Zieglers are close allies of Governor Ron DeSantis, and Moms for Liberty heavily promoted his anti-LGBTQ and anti-sex education campaign, including Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay law. Everyone knows that the culture warriors of Moms for Liberty tried to impose a traditional moral code on Americans that its co-founder doesn't follow, said Mary Ellen Klass in Bloomberg. It's time they disband. Moms for Liberty has already been tearing itself apart for months, said David Gilbert in Wired. Founded in 2021 to protest COVID mask mandates and school closures, it claims to have 130,000 members and 300 chapters in 48 states, but was a potent force only in staunchly conservative areas. This fall, 70% of Moms for Liberty's endorsed candidates lost their school board races, as voters recoiled from the group's extremist book banning agenda. One member was exposed as a convicted child molester. Two leaders posed in photos with members of the far-right Proud Boys militia. Ziegler's sex scandal could now deal the fatal blow. That obituary is premature, said Jennifer C. Berkshire and Jack Schneider in The Nation. Even if Moms for Liberty fades away, the parental rights crusade will continue with the real mission, which is to undermine public education by creating anger and resentment over teachings on sex and race. The Conservative Heritage Foundation and the Republican Party itself are leading that mission, hoping to steer public funding to religious and other private schools and to homeschooling. These issues aren't going anywhere. And a few of the short notes. Only 26 congressional bills made it into law this year, putting this Congress on track to be the least productive Congress in more than 90 years. The previous Congress, the 117th, passed 365 laws during its two-year term. The 116th passed 344, and the 115th passed 443. Since 2018, more than 2,000 residents of assisted living and dementia care units in the U.S. have wandered away undetected or been left unattended for hours outside. Nearly 100 of those residents died from causes including drowning, being hit by cars, and exposure to extreme heat or cold. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg is constructing a 1,400-acre compound in Hawaii that will cost an estimated $270 million, making it one of the most expensive properties in the world. The complex, centered on two mansions, will have at least 30 bedrooms, numerous elevators, an industrial-sized kitchen, and a 5,000-square-foot underground shelter with its own energy and food supplies and blast-resistant door. Homelessness in the U.S. climbed by a record 12% between 2022 and 2023, as rents rocketed up and pandemic aid expired. More than 650,000 Americans were homeless on a single night in January 2023, according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the highest number since reporting began in 2007. Much of the increase was driven by people becoming homeless for the first time. And we'll finish the show with a quote. Let's see. We'll do author Philip Pullman, quoted in Reformed Journal. "Thou shalt not" might reach the head, but it takes once upon a time to reach the heart. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.